Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. In honor of New York Fashion Week, we'll hear a nice talk on the fashion business and the cosmetic plastic surgery business and the diet food business and the other businesses that make you hate your body for fun and especially profit. I hope you'll stay tuned. Fashion Week ended in New York on September 11. Now, New York Fashion Week is one of those recurring extravaganzas of which I would remain blissfully unaware if the corporate media didn't rub my face in it. Just like the Super Bowl, or Windsor, Connecticut's annual Shad Derby, or the President's annual State of the Union blither. No offense to Windsor. I don't know if Fashion Week made your local newspaper, but the New York Times played it big. Sure, in New York, fashion is a big local industry, and also a big advertiser. Now, the New York Times company is trying to promote the paper by giving away free copies at the college where I teach. This looks like a doomed attempt to get young people to read something that is more than 160 characters long. Good luck with that. I've never actually seen a college student pick up a free copy of the Times, though it probably does happen once in a while. But I'm a scholar of rhetoric and composition, and I love to study how imperial propaganda works. So I like the New York Times plenty. So that's how I heard about Fashion Week. Have you seen a photo or a video of a fashion show runway model lately? The current style is they all have a grim, unhappy look on their faces. It would be great if that were a political statement, an act of rebellion. Show the world how unhappy you are with your lousy salary, zero benefits, zero job security, and grim working conditions. Also, Calvin Klein can get richer still. That would be neat, but I don't think that's why all the ladies look grim and unhappy. Not when they all have exactly the same grim expression on their faces. No, grim looks on models are just this season's edgy fashion statement, demanded by the fashion director. When was the last time you saw a fashion show model with even a hint of a smile on her face? Gazing at the runway photos from Fashion Week, I noticed that all the models are not only grim-faced, but, of course, very, very thin. It's tempting to connect the two. How happy would you look if you had to keep your weight below 90 so you could fit into a size 2 dress? I know I'd look pretty grim, especially if I had to wear high heels, too. Fashion Week's thin, grim models reminded me of a really interesting talk I heard. It's by Rebecca Anshel Song. She spoke in Chicago in June 2013. She called her talk Sexism and the Food and Diet Industry. The title does not do the talk justice. Her talk is a wide-ranging and interesting look at how bizarre standards of human beauty get foisted upon us by the food industry, the diet industry, the plastic surgery industry, and capitalism in general. Impossible and weird standards of beauty foist upon us, and of course, especially foist upon women. That's this week's portion of the talk. And then next week, in part two, we'll hear even more about the so-called war on obesity and of established powers' love of blaming the victim rather than acknowledging the shambles the powerful have made of our food system and our healthcare system and our whole economic system, especially working conditions. Yes, that's all connected to the obesity epidemic, so-called. Altogether, it's a neat talk, and Rebecca Song ties together a whole lot of cultural phenomena, and she shows the economic and political forces behind them. And she starts off with fashion. So, in honor of New York Fashion Week, live from Chicago, here is Rebecca Angel Song.
Whether the other women in their line of eyesight are skinnier or heavier than they are, whether or not they've exercised enough, whether or not other people find them repulsive, and the list goes on and on. A Glamour magazine survey not too long ago found that 97% of women, so basically all women, have an I hate my body moment every day. And the average was that they have these thoughts once every waking hour. As an example of how this obsession works, I want to read a quote from an eating disorder recovery forum. This woman said, "I can't remember a time when my whole life didn't revolve around my weight. My mood is based on what my scale says every morning. I decide what I'll eat today depending on that scale. I pull it out several times a day to see what it says, several times a day getting undressed, and then criticizing myself for weighing too much. I don't think I'll ever be happy." Now, obviously not every woman has this exact relationship with a scale, but it's clear that most women feel enormous pressure to look a certain way, to look differently than they do, specifically to be a particular weight, and this causes an enormous amount of anxiety and unhappiness. So what I'm hoping to do today is explore why these very broad and deep-seated problems exist among so many women, what is actually behind the horrible way we view our bodies. And I also want to challenge some of the typical assumptions that are often made about dieting and body weight. And then finally, I'll talk a little bit about what it would take to actually build an alternative to this, where people would have access to healthy food and healthcare, and where women would not be psychologically damaged with regard to their bodies. So where is this obsession with women's bodies coming from? I'm sure most of us in this room are conscious of the way that women's bodies and sexuality are used to sell everything from hamburgers to deodorant. Really, women's bodies are used not only to sell products, but to sell a particular image of what women should look like. And young women grow up with a nearly constant assault of images reflecting this particular body ideal. And these images of bodies, by the way, are increasingly thin. So the average model today weighs 23% less than the average woman and is between a size 0 and 4. In fact, the majority of runway models actually meet the weight criteria to be considered anorexic. Sizes 6 to 14 are now modeled by plus-size models in the fashion industry. And even mannequins are dramatically undersized. So if the average mannequin were brought to life, it would be so thin that it would not be able to menstruate. And those model sizes, by the way, are pre-Photoshop. So since most media images now are altered, the images are even more unrealistic for the majority of women because they literally don't exist in nature. Every blemish, even the unsightly bones protruding from models that are extremely thin, are photoshopped out. As an extreme example of this, Ralph Lauren came under fire a few years ago for publishing an altered picture of a model in which her pelvis appeared to be narrower than her head. And frankly, the statistics are out there, but we don't really need them to know that women's sense of self-worth and attractiveness is severely impacted by seeing thousands of images each year of what is largely an unattainable body shape. I think it's important to note as well that while at one time this particular body ideal was primarily dominant in the U.S. and Western European countries, the vast expansion of global capitalism over the last several decades has meant that the super thin, large-breasted white woman is now a cultural ideal in most of the world, including places that had quite different standards for female beauty just a few decades ago. For many women of color, this has brought along a particular pressure to look more like the white thin ideal. In a journal article titled "Spreading the Religion of Thinness," Michelle Lelwicka points out that there have been documented increases in eating disorders and plastic surgery in a number of countries over the last couple of decades, including South Africa, China, and Lebanon. She also points out that over 50% of the ads in women's magazines in Mexico, Colombia, Chile, and Venezuela featured models described as young, white, and thin. This process of globalizing the super thin body ideal for women only further underscores the fact that this isn't just some sort of natural biological preference that people have, but rather it is manufactured, and it's very specific to the time and place in which we live. So if we know that this is something that's being actively promoted, then the question we need to be asking is who benefits from this pressure on women? And the first and most obvious answer is that there are enormous profits built into promoting women's insecurity with their bodies. And I do want to take a little bit of time to actually look at where the money goes. So to start with the food industry, within the capitalist system, the way businesses survive, of course, is by engaging in a constant drive to maximize profits and growth and to minimize their costs. So the primary result of this in the food industry is that there are horrifically low standards, both for the working conditions of agricultural workers and for the food itself, because safety costs money and cuts into their profit margins. The goal is to grow and manufacture food as cheaply as possible. What this has meant is an increasing reliance on food that in many respects isn't really food at all. And it has meant that because these companies control the market, the food that most people have access to is very unhealthy, and our diets are vastly different than they were 60 years ago. This has, of course, contributed to changes in our health. Then during the 1980s, the food industry realized that it could dramatically increase its profits by also capitalizing on people's desire to lose weight. The result was that they started to manufacture so-called health foods using cheaper chemicals to replace standard ingredients. And as Charlene Hesse-Biber pointed out in her book, The Cult of Thinness, which we have at Haymarket, light beer had more water in it. The saccharin in diet drinks was cheaper than sugar. Especially profitable were dairy analogs fabricated from inexpensive vegetable fats, margarine, egg substitutes, creamers, frozen dinners, and light cheeses. These diet foods have been an amazing profit windfall for the food industry because not only are they cheaper to produce, but they're often sold at a higher cost because millions of people who are desperately trying to lose weight will actually pay a premium if they think a certain food will help them in that process. Now, of course, there are even more varieties of specialty foods today, including so-called natural foods that cost even more than the diet foods from the same companies. And then, you know, food advertising also, you know, very clearly kind of reflects this relationship that the industry has with sexism and dieting. In 2011, Yoplait pulled an ad off the air after outcry that it essentially promoted eating disorders. And it was a commercial where a thin woman was looking longingly at a slice of raspberry cheesecake and nervously trying to figure out how she could allow herself to indulge. And her ideas were, I can eat it while jogging in place, or I can just eat celery for the rest of the day. Then an even thinner woman came up to the fridge and took a raspberry cheesecake flavored Yoplait yogurt out and walked away. And of course, the first woman, you know, gave up the idea of having the cheesecake and had the yogurt instead. The pushback from eating disorder advocacy groups rightly said that showing a woman having major anxiety over eating a dessert and then deciding to deny herself the dessert only reinforces that this sort of disordered relationship we have to food is normal. But for Yoplait, like for many other companies, this was a logical way to advertise because they want to boost sales by promoting their food as the right choice for women who want to be thin. The flip side of the food industry is, of course, the diet industry. This includes a lot of different types of companies. There are diet programs like Weight Watchers and Jenny Craig, diet books, food replacement products like SlimFast or the Hollywood Cookie Diet, nutritional supplements, prescription drugs, motivational speakers, diet doctors, and probably many more varieties that I haven't even listed. And the very interesting thing about the diet industry is that regardless of the diet or product being promoted, none of them could statistically be said to work. Most estimates are that more than 80% of people who successfully lose weight while dieting regain all of the weight or more weight than they lost after 2 years. It's in the diet industry's interest to blame this on individual failure because it keeps people coming back over and over again. But of course, if other products or medical procedures had an 80% failure rate, they probably wouldn't be able to advertise themselves very confidently anymore. In Laura Fraser's book, Losing It, she talks about how in the 1980s, diet programs like Jenny Craig, were openly advertising themselves to highlight the fact that you would need to keep coming back. So Jenny Craig had an ad that compared dieting with getting your hair done. Just something you have to do over and over again to keep it up. Now today, there's a little more awareness about the risks of yo-yo dieting, so they tend to use the language of lifestyle changes instead. But their fundamental model hasn't really shifted. They still rely on people losing weight while they stick to the plan, leaving and gaining the weight back, feeling like a personal failure for regaining the weight, and then signing up for the program again. Of course, beyond the major diet programs, there are a whole host of other segments of the diet industry, some of which are actually quite dangerous. Individuals and companies promote fad diets like the baby food diet, the grapefruit diet, the blood type diet, and on and on. There are numerous supplements that claim to help people lose weight, which are barely or not at all regulated by the FDA. Many major stores, you know, CVS, major drug stores, still sell weight loss cleanses, diuretics, Hoodia, which has been known to cause increased heart rate. And if you really want it, it's still possible to buy Mahuang, which is ephedra, online, which is basically speed. Doctors can still prescribe HCG injections for weight loss, which is a hormone produced by pregnant women that is known to cause headaches, blood clots, and other significant side effects. All of this together adds up to an enormous industry that now makes at least $61 billion a year selling fake solutions to women and some men, some of which are deadly. Then, of course, there's the plastic surgery industry. This industry especially benefits from the fact that the ideal for women's bodies is actually an amalgam of the impossible. Women are supposed to be thin, toned, have tiny hips, flat stomachs, and at the same time have really big breasts. And this rarely occurs naturally. In 2010, over 1.6 million plastic surgery procedures were done, with breast augmentation and liposuction topping the list. And of course, we know that plastic surgeons are notorious for intentionally lowering women's self-esteem in order to convince them to go under the knife. In fact, not long ago, news hit that a plastic surgeon went to a career day at an elementary school in Virginia and brought breast implants for show and tell. Because apparently no girl is too young to realize that her breasts are too small. And the scope of plastic surgery has broadened as well. In recent years, vaginal rejuvenation surgery has become a procedure. Oh, it gets worse. Somewhere around 5,000 women in the U.S. get each year, with the most common version being labiaplasty, which includes a procedure called the Barbie, which removes the entire labia minora so that only the outer labia are visible. As smooth as plastic is how they describe it. Frankly, the idea that even vulva are supposed to look a certain way shows just how oppressive the pressure on our bodies is. And it's outrageous that this obsession has reached every part of a woman's body. And I want to add that although some cosmetic medical procedures are very expensive and limited to, you know, ruling class women, the prevalence of lower cost procedures has been growing quite a bit. A survey of physicians a few years ago showed that Botox is now more commonly used by women who have household incomes between $50,000 and $100,000 than it is by wealthier women. Doctors are intentionally marketing cheap procedures to make more money. In Hesse Biber's book, she quotes a plastic surgeon who talks about the growth of assembly line surgery. He says, in Massachusetts, an MD is licensed to perform any type of plastic surgery he or she wants. If they do not want to spend the money opening up a surgery clinic, all they need to do is team up with an MBA who buys a clinic and says to the doctor, okay, get to work and start doing suction lipectomies as many as you can. There's no law that says he cannot. He can hire an MD with no training and say, we'll show you a movie on how to do it. Now, obviously, this, like many other aspects of this issue, is very closely tied in with the absolutely disgusting profit-based healthcare system in the U.S., because the idea of having factory assembly line-style invasive surgery is really something that only makes sense from the perspective of the person that's profiting from it. But this major profit source also couldn't exist if women weren't being systematically trained to hate their bodies. Rather than cosmetic surgery being a way for people to resolve medical issues or restore their appearance after accidents, it's become another very dangerous way for women to try to reach the cultural standards of beauty. So there are numerous sources of profits to be made for promoting an obsession about weight and beauty among women. Nonetheless, that still doesn't paint the whole picture about what drives this. The massive profits certainly go a long way towards sustaining this pressure on women. But it's also important to situate the diet and beauty industries in the broader context of women's oppression in our society. Beyond the immediate profits, the constant pressure on women to be thin and pretty serves an ideological purpose in the process of maintaining women's oppression in general. On the one hand, as several feminist theorists have pointed out, it causes women to devote an enormous amount of time, energy, and money to fixing themselves, focusing their attention inward to their own faults. Laura Fraser describes this as a third job that women hold, a psychologically exhausting, time-consuming, and expensive job on top of their jobs in the workplace and in the home. But more importantly, I think this focus on women's bodies and appearance trivializes women and reduces their value to their appearance. Mm-hmm. Women in our society are supposed to be defined far more by their looks than by any other aspect of their existence. Women are trained to see themselves as others see them and evaluate their own worth from the assumed preferences of others, specifically men that they have to impress in order to get a man and get married. As Susie Orbach, the author of Fat is a Feminist Issue, put it, to get a man, a woman has to learn to regard herself as an item, a commodity, a sex object. Much of her experience and identity depends on how she and others see her. This emphasis on presentation as the central aspect of a woman's existence makes her extremely self-conscious. It demands that she occupy herself with a self-image that others will find pleasing and attractive, an image that will immediately convey what kind of woman she is. She must observe and evaluate herself, scrutinizing every detail of herself as though she were an outside judge. She attempts to make herself in the image of womanhood presented by billboards, newspapers, magazines, and television. The media present women either in a sexual context or within the family, reflecting a woman's two prescribed roles, first as a sex object, then as a mother. She's brought up to marry by catching a man with her good looks and pleasing manner. This process of sexual objectification of women, heavily influenced by media images and the industries we've already discussed, produces an environment in which it is seen as acceptable for individual men to treat women as objects. In many ways, both men and women are trained throughout life to view women's needs and desires as secondary to hypothetical male preferences. As a result, women are bombarded by comments on their body while walking down the street. They endure sexual harassment in the workplace and ultimately face the threat of rape. This is no coincidence, because the oppression of women is extremely beneficial to the ruling class. And by training all of us to view this as sort of natural and inevitable and just part of our preferences about what women should look like, sexist ideas and practices become ingrained into our world. I don't really have time today to expand on the mechanics behind the role of women's oppression under capitalism, but I would certainly encourage people to attend other sessions at this conference that will look more closely at that. So women's objectification serves an important purpose in reinforcing women's oppression overall, and although objectification of women's bodies has been an issue since at least the early part of the 20th century, it should come as no surprise that we've seen a dramatic increase in this objectification since the 1980s, going along with a right-wing and ruling class backlash to the women's movement. In the last several years, however, this focus on women's bodies has actually expanded to include an intensified effort to shame fat people in general and to blame all manner of social problems on an increase in average body weight. And so at this point, I want to kind of shift my focus and take a critical look at the what's called the war on obesity.
And there we must end this week's part of the talk. We've been listening to Rebecca Anshel Song speaking on sexism and the food and diet industry. Tune in next week for the rest. One thing I like about the talk is that Song does not pin the blame on abstractions. If you think your hips are too wide, and your breasts are too small, and your weight is too high, and your genitals are ugly, if you think like this, the culprit that's making you feel bad about yourself is not an abstraction like sexism, or patriarchal oppression, or objectification of women, or society. Song says, let's not pin all the blame on abstractions. If you're unhappy with your body, The villains are not abstractions, but real human beings who have organized themselves into business corporations. They're doing to you what they're doing to you for one practical, down-to-earth reason. They want to make a buck off of you. Song suggests, if we have to talk about some abstractions, let's not focus on just looksism or sexism. Let's focus on capitalism. Makes sense to me. And with that, I will bid you good afternoon. Thanks to wearemany.org for the audio. My name is Kenneth Doust. New World Notes comes to you from the spacious underground studios of WWUHFM, a community service of that beacon of light in darkest Connecticut, the University of Hartford. Recordings of our past shows are available free at our website, which is newworldnotes.blogspot.com. I'd be glad to get your feedback on the program, too. You can leave a comment on the website, or you can send me an email. And you'll find my email address at the website, so that's a good place to start. Once again, the site is newworldnotes.blogspot.com. Thank you for listening. I'll get to my non-carborundum, and please come back again next week. Ciao.